Okay, meanwhile, back to the ranch. You know, substance abuse we can get to in special topics if people want to. We also, I think there's a chapter about it in clinical applications. Right now we're on anxiety. And first of all, let's go to the videotape and just a brief example.
So many things that I don't know where to start. I feel like my heart starts pounding faster because I want to do everything at once to get them out of the way. And what usually happens is that before the day is halfway over, I do finish what I have to do, but I'm worried that I didn't do it right. Now I start going back over it again, thinking maybe I didn't do it right. How could I have finished so quickly? And it goes on and on. You go home at night, you look back at it, you think about it, and it's just worry all the time.
Okay, so, you know, with depression, we've gotten a nice downward spiral of depression. Is that what's going on with anxiety? No, I don't hear a negative view of self and, et cetera. You know, the bits of his thoughts that he expressed there spontaneously, there's so much to do, how will I ever get it done? Oops, I got it done. How did I get it done so quickly? I must not have done a good enough job. And cognition certainly is playing an important role there. But what's going on with anxiety is a bit different than what's going on with depression. So how are we going to understand anxiety and figure out how to be helpful to people? The thinking of the anxious person is dominated by themes of danger and threat. And there's a lot of anticipating bad stuff happening. You know, from this brief segment, we don't know that he's reacting as though if he doesn't get it all done, there's something serious about this. If he didn't do it well enough, there's something serious about this. And, you know, the way I often explain it to clients, if you think about it, you know, the environment humans developed for was being hunter-gatherers out on the savannah. And if we're living in trees and gathering nuts and berries, you know, if the guy next to me gets eaten by a tiger, it's rather handy if I immediately get scared and want to run away screaming, because then I don't get eaten. This is good. This propagates the species. And it's rather handy if from that point on I've got a fear of big hairy animals that keeps me away from tigers in the future. This is pretty adaptive, particularly back before we had language and culture and sidearms and park rangers and so on. And, you know, it was more adaptive for me to be overly timid, and if I'm scared of deer and bunny rabbit as well as tigers, big deal. It was much better to be too cautious than too bold. And so you could build up a pretty good case that as a species, we're wired to pick up fears quickly and easily and to be slow to let go of them, because otherwise we would talk ourselves into doing stupid stuff and get eaten by the next tiger. Now, the environment has changed a lot in the last 10,000 years. When's the last time you had to escape a major predator? It doesn't come up that often. And most of the things we find ourselves being afraid of are not the immediate, concrete, oh my God, I'm going to get eaten. You know, for those of you who were hesitant to volunteer for the, you have a case in mind for next time, how many were afraid of being eaten? No. That's, you know, how many were afraid of looking dumb? Probably everybody who hesitated to volunteer. You know, we're now, but the same processes are wired in biologically. Because the biology doesn't change that fast. And so you could build the good case that we're wired to escape predators in an environment where escaping predators doesn't come up. In other, less concrete fears like looking dumb come up much more. And, you know, as a species, we're probably wound a little too tight. But also, like anything that's wired in biologically, it varies from person to person. And some people are wound a lot tighter than others. You know, I happen to be a mellow, laid-back guy. I don't get credit for that. My dad's a mellow, laid-back guy. My son's a mellow, laid-back guy. The odds are good. There's a major genetic component there. It does make me less prone to problems with anxiety and probably more prone to problems with depression. You know, other people are more high strung and they're more prone to anxiety problems and less prone to, and we each have our own characteristics. And this plays out in some complex ways. Let's turn to page 10 in the handouts, where we've got a handy-dandy model of anxiety. You'll notice it's got some similarities with the model of stress, which is not surprising since I drew both diagrams. But focusing specifically on anxiety, up at the top, we've got the individual's beliefs about themselves and the world, and we've got the situation or physical sensation or thought or image that they're reacting to. And basically, we're wired so that our brain is constantly and automatically in the background on the alert, on the lookout for threat, danger, problems. This is a good thing, because if our brain didn't do that, we'd suddenly find ourselves in the midst of a disaster without having seen it coming. And when we run into a challenging situation, our brain quickly and automatically balances, how dangerous is this? Can I deal with it? And the balance between my, what technically is called a sense of self-efficacy. It's not self-esteem, it's situation-specific. Can I handle this situation? The balance between that and our perception of the dangers in the situation determines how anxious we feel. Now, if I levitate you up on a narrow ledge on a mountainside, the odds are you would find yourself being really scared. Not only are you not used to being levitated places, but also a narrow ledge on a mountainside seems pretty dangerous. If I slip, I scream for a little while, and then I go splat. This is an objectively dangerous situation. If I levitate a mountain climber up onto that ledge, is he going to be equally scared? Well, he's going to be freaked about levitation because he's not used to that either. But once he gets over that, he's not going to freak out because he's on a narrow ledge on a mountainside. Why? Because he's confident he can handle that. Why is he confident he can handle that? Well, part of it is he's done it before. Another part of it is he knows things about narrow ledges on mountainsides that you don't. The odds are you'd find yourself clinging as close to the face of the cliff as possible. The mountain climber is going to keep his body out away from the cliff face because you're a lot more stable that way. But you don't know that if you haven't done any rock climbing. And also, he's in practice at it, so his rock climbing muscles are probably going to be in better shape than your rock climbing muscles. Now, I haven't done any rock climbing in 15 years. Okay, those muscles are out of shape. My muscles for playing racquetball and fencing are in shape. And so there are a couple different reasons why the mountain climber is going to have a higher sense of self-efficacy than you do. And as with stress, it's a dynamic model. This is my initial level of stress is based on my initial sense of how dangerous the situation and is my capacity to cope. If I see the demands of the situation exceeding my ability to cope, I'm going to see the situation as dangerous and I'm going to experience some anxiety. And then once I'm experiencing anxiety, the anxiety has a number of important effects. One is that we're wired to have a background level of vigilance going on all the time. But when I become more anxious, my vigilance goes up. So, for example, if you go out walking in the metro parks, there's a part of your brain that's constantly and automatically on the lookout for lions and tigers and bears because that's the way we've evolved. On the other hand, situational things can crank that up. If you happen to be stressed out, you're going to be more vigilant because that's the way we work. When I was a kid, our family lived in the last subdivision on the edge of town, and my friends and I spent lots of time running around in the woods. And, one day we were out walking in the woods, and somebody brought up the question of, gee, I wonder if there are any bears in the woods. It just seems like a big patch of woods. It seems like there would be bears here. Same patch of woods we'd run around in for years, but we were talking about bears. And then there was rustling in the bushes, and we all freaked and ran. And then we looked back, and it turned out to be a bunny rabbit. And there really weren't any bears within 100 miles of there, because they'd all been hunted out. But, anything that stirs up a little anxiety then has me more vigilance. And on the plus side, if I'm vigilant, I'm more quicker to spot the whatever I'm concerned about if it happens. If a bear showed up, we'd spot it right away. But it also sets me up for false alarms. You know, if I'm on the lookout for bears and there's rustling in the bushes, it might be a bear. It might be a bunny rabbit, the wind, the deer, etc. And so, you know, and so all in all, our tendency to be vigilant when we're anxious increases our perception of risk. Partly because we notice real dangers that are there. You know, if I'm at a buffet and I start thinking about food poisoning, you know, I'm going to find myself thinking about how long has this stuff been out? Is it at an appropriate temperature, etc.? You know, if the stuff has been out unrefrigerated and unheated for too long, I may make good choices about whether to have a second helping. Or I may scare myself needlessly, depending on how much I know about food poisoning. And so the vigilance tends to increase our perception of risk, both because we spot real risk and because of false alarms. And as I see more danger, then my level of anxiety is going to go up. And as my level of anxiety goes up, I'm going to be more vigilant. So we've got a potential positive feedback loop there. Another thing that ties back into what we were just talking about with stress, as my anxiety goes up, I'm going to start having somatic symptoms of anxiety. Maybe my heart starts pounding. Maybe my stomach does flip-flops. Maybe my hands start shaking. And you know, this is now part of the situation I'm dealing with. Not only do I have my previous concerns about the job interview, but, oh my God, my hand's shaking. Maybe they'll notice that and wonder why I'm anxious and ask tougher questions. And we've got that potential positive feedback loop, the classic example. We've got the panic attacks next time. You know, I get anxious. I know my heart's pounding, and I don't put two and three. Gee, what's going on with my heart? I wonder if there's anything wrong. Which scares me more, so my heart, oh my God, my heart's pounding faster. There must be something wrong, which scares me more. And we're off and running in a panic attack. And you think about the anxious clients you've had, a lot of people get really scared of what's going on with them physically or what's going on. Oh my God, am I going crazy? You know. And so we've got that feedback loop there. Another really important one is, when we get anxious, we're wired so that we humans tend to avoid whatever's scary. If the guy at the front of the room says, volunteers for consultation next time, and you've got a little anxiety about that, what do you find yourself doing? You find yourself keeping your mouth shut and not volunteering. Completely understandable. And the way it plays out with avoidance is, if I avoid what's scary, it feels good at the moment. Okay, somebody else volunteered. We get to go on break. I'm off the hook. Now, does that make you comfortable volunteering next time? No. And one time avoiding something, no big deal. But the more often you avoid a situation, the more it seems to your brain that this is a scary situation I can't handle. My sense of self-efficacy goes down the more I avoid the situation, which makes the situation scarier, which increases my tendency to avoid it, which undercuts my sense of self-efficacy. And so, you know, for example, how do anxiety problems develop? Well, sometimes a person has a really scary situation, and it makes perfect sense. You know, when I was a kid, we were over at a friend's house one time, and playing with his dog, and the dog jumped up and bit one of my friends on the nose. It came very close to taking the tip of his nose off. Okay, it would make perfect sense if after that the guy was afraid of dogs. Having it turned out he didn't have the sense to be afraid of dogs. That was the kids I grew up with. You know, and sometimes a person's had a really scary situation, and it makes it easy to understand why they're afraid of whatever. Other times there's no obvious traumatic experience. What's going on here? Well, mundane, ordinary experiences can easily snowball. Imagine I get up on a stepladder to change a light bulb. It feels a little rickety. I have an image of falling and hurting myself, so I get back down off the stepladder. A, the light bulb hasn't been changed. I have to con Barb into doing it. B, the next time I have occasion to get on the stepladder, I'm going to be a little more likely to avoid it. And if I got a half dozen times when I really should get up on the stepladder, but I weasel out of it in one way or another, I'm going to find myself more and more uncomfortable with stepladders. Nothing terrible has happened. I haven't actually been hurt. I haven't actually fallen. But simply avoiding it undercuts my confidence that this is a situation I can handle. And then I go to the mall and take the little glass elevator from the first level to the second level, and it feels a little unsteady. It feels a little like being on a stepladder, and I feel anxious, and I start avoiding the glass elevator. And then I'm at the mall walking along the upper level, and I look over the side, and it seems high up, and I feel uncomfortable, so I find myself walking close to the storefront rather than by the railing. And then after a while of doing this, I'm driving down 480 and I come to the Valley View Bridge, and oh my God, this is scary to go over the bridge. And I can gradually ramp my way up into a clinical level of a fear of heights. Nothing bad has happened. But avoidance snowballs released. How's all this sound so far? And, you know, so we, on the cognitive level, we cut two different things: my perception of danger in the situation, which may or may not be realistic, and my perception of my ability to cope, which may or may not be realistic. If I see the situation as being more dangerous than I can handle, that's going to generate anxiety. And we've got these ramifications of anxiety, and the more I avoid, the more things are going to snowball, and the more likely it is that I'm going to ramp my way up to the point where this is a problem for me. And if I happen to be an anxiety-prone individual, this is going to happen more quickly and easily. If I happen to grow up in a family that modeled avoiding scary situations, or modeled worrying about stuff, or modeled being on the lookout for signs of threat, then that's going to set the stage to make it easier to get into this. Any questions so far? And so, you know, what does this say about intervention? Well, hey, we got some dysfunctional thoughts in here. Seems like what I should do is pinpoint the thoughts, help the person look at it critically, examine the evidence. Hey, it's scary. Up on the stepladder is scary. You know, what convinces you that getting on the stepladder is a bad idea? What evidence is there that doesn't fit with that, et cetera? We, you know, get it clear that stepladders are, you know, scary but not dangerous. Shouldn't that make the person's anxiety go away? It would be wonderful if it worked that way. Our job would be a lot easier if it worked that way. Not every emotion works the same. With depression, looking at things critically and realizing, wait, the situation isn't hopeless. Wait, I'm not a loser. Wait, things aren't as bad as they look. Makes a difference in how it feels right away for most people. You know, with grief, you know, it doesn't even make any sense to try to think it through and realize it's not a bad thing that that person died. You know, with anxiety, thinking it through and realizing it's scary but not dangerous doesn't poof make the anxiety go away. That's not the way anxiety works. Fear of flying is a great example. The odds are good that you've got a friend or relative with fear of flying. The odds are good that they know intellectually flying is a scheduled airline is safer than freeway driving. Does that make them comfortable getting on an airplane? No. You know, if they want to be comfortable getting on an airplane, what do they need to do? The short answer is they need to get their butt on the damn airplane and fly and land safely, and doing it once is not enough. But if they can get themselves to do it 6 or 8 times, they're likely to notice, hey, I'm not nearly as scared as I used to be. And in the old days, you know, this was thought of as a conditioning thing. I get conditioned to be scared of something, which only makes sense if there's a traumatic experience. And then if I face it and nothing bad happens, I get deconditioned. It turns out conditioning was a misunderstanding of what goes on there. And it turns out from current research, our best understanding of what's going on the concrete level is it's new learning. You know, I've learned over time, oh my God, this is a dangerous situation. If I avoid the situation, I don't have the opportunity to have any contradictory experiences and learn that the situation isn't dangerous. If I face the situation, then I have the opportunity to discover, either I discover the situation's not dangerous, what I'm afraid of doesn't happen, or I discover what I'm afraid of happens and I can deal with it. And it's this confirmation of expectancies and new learning that turns out to be the operative factor in getting to the point where the anxiety is not a problem. And there are two different ways we can get to the point where the anxiety is not a problem. I can face the situation, you know, often enough, persistently enough to get comfortable with the situation, in which case it's probably not going to be a problem for me. Or I can face it enough to get to the point where I'm confident that I can deal with the situation, I can deal with my anxiety, and I can go ahead and do it despite being anxious, in which case it's not a problem. Again, fear of flying is a good example. You know, if I fly often enough and we set things up right, the odds are excellent we can get to the point where the person's comfortable with flying. But flying costs money. Most people don't have the opportunity to fly repeatedly. You know, it takes time, it takes money, etc. Another perfectly fine outcome is get to the point where, yes, flying freaks me out, but I can tolerate being anxious, I can cope with my anxiety, I can get myself on the airplane despite being anxious, and I can get to Orlando, which is the whole point to this operation. You know, being comfortable with being nice, but the important thing is to be able to get on the airplane when I want to get on the airplane. And both of those are perfectly fine outcomes. Both of those are successes. You know, and, you know, one thing that makes a difference between the two is, it feasible, is it worth the time and effort and expense and trouble to face the situation enough to get comfortable with it? Or do I want to shoot simply for being able to go ahead and do it despite being uncomfortable? You know, another good example would be anxiety about public speaking. About 60% of the American public is nervous about getting up in front of a group. We know from research and experience that if the person simply gets their butt up in front of an audience on a regular basis, 70% of the time that's all it takes to get comfortable with public speaking. But it takes an investment of time and energy. I have to hustle around and find opportunities to get up in front of an audience. Most of us, this does not come up real often in day-to-day life. I might need to join Toastmasters so I have an opportunity to get up in front of the group and give a talk, you know, weekly. And if I'm willing to get up early and hit Toastmasters on my way to work and, you know, get up in front of an audience on a regular basis, you know, the odds are good that in a couple months I'll be comfortable with public speaking and also a lot better at it. You know, there are also plenty of people where sounds good on paper, but they don't want to get up early and put in the time and energy it takes to get comfortable with public speaking. They might want to settle for getting to the point where they can go ahead and get up in front of an audience despite being nervous and do what needs to be done. You know, they might decide that being comfortable is not worth the extra trouble. How's all this episode? Yeah.
Is this similar to how you might work with someone with chronic pain? I work with a lot of people, their issues. They have a physical thing that brings them pain frequently, and they feel the pain, and then the anxiety about the pain becomes so severe it sends them to the opioid or the emergency room. Or
and it, there certainly is the same way we would deal with the anxiety component of chronic pain.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but another part of it with pain is the focus of attention makes a big difference in the experience of pain. You know, if I sprain my ankle, it hurts. If I sprain my ankle and I'm watching a DVD, I'm in a conversation, whatever, the odds are it hurts a lot less. As soon as the DVD ends, I hang up the phone, whatever, it hurts again. The physical component has not gone away, but if I'm focused on something else, I don't experience the pain to the same extent. If I sit there and focus on my ankle, it hurts a lot more. And in addition to our tendency to be vigilant for signs of threat, we also have a wired-in tendency to focus on anything that's not right, anything that's unpleasant, anything we dislike. The example I use with clients is, you know, if I've got a pebble in my shoe, I automatically notice it. I don't have to stop and think about it. I don't have to pay attention to it. We're wired to just automatically notice that. And with pebbles and shoes, this is a good idea. You know, if my feet are doing just fine, I don't notice that my feet are doing just fine. I'm focused on other stuff. And our brain has a tendency to just automatically focus on pain. Because pain is supposed to be a signal that this is broken, this is injured. You know, don't walk on that foot. But with chronic pain, you know, often it's not a useful signal anymore. And that often with chronic pain, I need to go ahead and use that part of my body so that, you know, I follow through on the physical therapy exercises and heal better and so on. But this is not natural. Humans are not wired that way. And so another part of working with chronic pain is helping people learn to shift their focus of attention when it's a good idea. There also are often a lot of catastrophic cognitions. I can't go on like this, etc., which really amplifies the impact of the pain. So there are a bunch of different chunks, but the anxiety chunk we deal with in the same way. And helping people recognize that it certainly is completely understandable that they're afraid that they'll move wrong and their back will hurt or whatever. But that though that's understandable and natural, this is not useful. And helping them work out strategies for backing off on the trying to anticipate pain. Being vigilant for pain and focusing on pain. That's all that stuff.
Sounds good.
One of the things on the avoidance front that I forgot to point out, unfortunately, I've got notes here, and which is one of the an important but non-obvious component. The example I use with clients, imagine I'm driving around town and I would prefer not to hit any potholes. Well, A, trying to avoid potholes is a perfectly fine idea. And with potholes, avoiding them turns out to be a good move. It works well. You know, now, that's partly because potholes are avoidable. If I'm trying to avoid anxiety, that's a little different. You know, can any of us go through life and never feel anxious? No. If you're neurologically intact, you're going to feel anxious from time to time. And trying to avoid all anxiety turns out to be really counterproductive. And in addition to the aspects I've talked about, if I'm trying to avoid potholes, what do I need to do? In order to avoid potholes, I need to be on the lookout for potholes so I spot them in time to avoid them. Avoidance increases vigilance. And with potholes, watching for them and avoiding them turns out to be a fine idea. But if I'm trying to avoid pain, this is going to have me on the lookout for pain, which is going to have me notice everything, every little twinge in my body, which is going to end up with me experiencing more pain. You know, or if I'm anxious about looking dumb, and I go through my day vigilant for all the different situations in which I could possibly look dumb, I'm going to spot lots of opportunities to look dumb. None of us has any shortage of opportunities to look dumb. Most of them are situations where I would handle just fine if I wasn't worrying about it. But if I'm on the lookout for the risk of embarrassment, I'm going to stress myself out about all sorts of situations. And how am I going to try to avoid embarrassing myself? The odds are I'll slip into try paying attention to what I say and do in the hopes of not saying or doing anything dumb. This is going to have me very self-conscious. And A, if I'm real self-conscious, this feels weird. And that right by itself freaks out plenty of people. But also, if I'm trying to carry on a conversation and I pay close attention to what I'm saying and doing, it increases cognitive load. Not only am I trying to carry on a conversation, but I'm trying to monitor everything. This makes the task harder. And you run into all, if I pay attention to how I'm moving my hands, suddenly I don't remember how I normally move my hands. Whatever I do feels dumb. I just wish they would crawl up my sleeve or something. You know, so the avoidance impacts vigilance in a way that just complicates things enormously. And if you think about it, if I just go through life and worry about it, does this guarantee I'll never look dumb? No, I'm going to look dumb from time to time. But if I can get my head around just going through life, not worried about it, and should I say or do something dumb, deal with it when it happens, that's much simpler, involves a lot less anxiety, works out just fine. Now, getting from here to there, you know, is not an easy thing. Yeah.
So in this case, I was just thinking about a client that I have, because that vigilance, sometimes for her case, it comes from trauma in the past. Mm-hmm. So like her her auntie was diagnosed with cancer. Her mom had cancer before. Mm-hmm. Her grandma died of two types of cancer. Mm-hmm. She's so anxious that she thinks she has cancer. Mm-hmm. And she cannot. She's always on the look. She was like, I'm thinking about dying every day. And mm-hmm. it's a really... So how...
Well, and that gets into a couple, you know, more aspects of this. You know, the sort of the unspoken concept here is, if I'm on the lookout for danger, this will enable me to spot it and avoid it. You know, it would be great if being vigilant for cancer enabled me to avoid cancer. Does cancer work that way?
No.
No, cancer is not something I can run away from. This is not good news. You know, and we get some additional complications on the belief and assumption level. You know, a lot of people in the course of growing up pick up the idea that, you know, worrying about disaster somehow prevents disaster or prepares me to deal with it, etc. So you may have a lot of cognition, a lot of beliefs that are basically in favor of worrying about stuff that play a role. And, you know, it would be great if worrying about cancer prevented cancer. I would sign up for that one if it worked. You know, the bad news is worrying about cancer doesn't prevent cancer. It just makes me miserable. And, you know, if I can get to the point where I can manage not to worry about it, you know, my prognosis is no better or worse. You know, worrying about cancer doesn't cause cancer either. You know, and we'll get to, you know, managing worry when we get to generalized anxiety syndrome, generalized anxiety disorder. You know, because there's some specialized strategies for helping people get decent at dealing with worry. And avoidance can take a lot of different forms. There's the obvious, staying off the ladder, staying away from big dogs, whatever, staying off of airplanes. But sometimes worry is a form of avoidance. In the person's head, it seems like if it worries about it, then it won't happen. And if you stop and think about it, how many times has this person worried about cancer? Hundreds or thousands. How many times has she had cancer? None so far. It's easy for it to feel like it's working. When I worry about cancer, I don't get cancer. You know, if I stopped worrying, then the cancer would hit. You know, is, you know, one of the complexities that often comes up as we get farther into working on anxiety problems. Another, you know, aspect of avoidance is we tend to avoid whatever is scary. You know, the thought of having cancer is scary. There are a lot of people who get into trying to not think about it, trying to shut it away, trying. And what happens if there's a thought and I try not to think about it?
You get overwhelmed.
Yeah, it backfires. The brain is wired to focus on whatever seems important. And makes a lot of sense. I'm going to got limited brain space. I'm going to focus on the important stuff. I'm going to ignore the unimportant stuff. Unfortunately, the part of the brain that handles that is relatively primitive. And it operates on some simple rules of thumb, which usually are a good idea, but not always. One of the rules of thumb it uses is our brain figures that whatever is scary must be important. And so if I'm scared of cancer, my brain reacts as though cancer is important, so I better think about cancer. And the more I think about cancer, the more it scares me. The more it scares me, the more it seems like I need to think about it. And that can easily become self-perpetuating. One can easily become preoccupied with it. Or, depending on how things balance within me, you know, this stuff is scary, I try not to think about it. And if there's something important and I'm trying not to think about it, my brain keeps bringing it back up. So a thought of cancer comes to mind, I shove it aside, and it pops back up, and I shove. And it's easy to end up being preoccupied with thoughts about cancer that way. You know, so this... The basic principles we're talking about are pretty simple and straightforward, but they get pretty convoluted when you look at how it plays out in real life.
So it's in the middle. If you stop, then you get preoccupied. If you do, then you get overwhelmed.
Yeah, and so one of our challenges is helping people develop good skills for coping with anxiety, which is not simple and straightforward. You know, first of all, you know, it doesn't get covered in school. Your parents don't sit you down and teach you about it. You know, most people don't know a whole lot about how to handle anxiety well. And it's easy to slip into things that seem like a good idea. You know, suppose I'm anxious about public speaking. I need to get up in front of a class and teach them about anxiety. A lot of people would find themselves preparing and preparing and preparing and rehearsing and rehearsing and rehearsing so as to guarantee they won't screw up. And on the surface, that sounds like a good strategy. What's the problem with that? Wait a minute, I'm afraid of screwing up. I'm putting a lot of time and energy into making sure that I don't screw up. This is avoidance behavior. And the more I put time and energy in over-the-top preparation in the hopes of guaranteeing I don't screw up, the more I'm going to be afraid of screwing up. And that easily becomes self-perpetuating. So what do we do about anxiety? Well, and we've got this summarized on the bottom of page 10. The general principle is, you know, avoidance reduces anxiety in the short term but perpetuates the problem and gradually makes it worse. On the flip side, if the person can face their fears in manageable steps, this gives them the opportunity to discover that their fears aren't reality-based, the opportunity to discover that they can cope with anxiety, the opportunity to discover that they can handle the situation successfully. And so what we need to do is understand what the person fears and help them persistently face their fears. Understand what the person avoids and help them persistently face it rather than avoiding it. People often engage in safety behaviors, maneuvers that give them a feeling of safety but don't actually accomplish anything. You know, a good example, Barb had a client once upon a time with who had a fear of vomiting in public. So what she did was she carried a large purse lined with a Ziploc. So if she had to vomit in public, she could barf into her purse. She never actually needed to do that. It wasn't that she had a problem with vomiting in public. She was afraid that someday she might vomit in public. She never actually needed to barf into her purse. You know, barfing into your purse wouldn't improve the situation any. It probably would look weirder to people than barfing on the floor would. But it gave her a feeling of safety, which is another form of avoidance. Here she's trying to avoid the anxiety. And so at some point in treatment, she's going to need to leave the purse home and go out without that, you know, safety behavior and discover that she can cope with reality and survive without having to carry a purse to barf into. So, you know, one way to think of it is, you know, think like a sadist. What does a person really want to avoid? We need to get them to face it. You know, what does a person really not want to feel? We need to get them to go ahead and feel it. You know, what does a person do to make themselves more comfortable? We need to get them to quit doing that and put up with being uncomfortable in the short run so that they can get to the point where they're comfortable, feel capable, can handle the situation in real life.
But at the same time, like the patient you explained, Barb's patient that who carries around a bit like that, if the client doesn't, I'm thinking that was one of the 30 goals, mm-hmm. if the client doesn't think it's an issue, it could be just something you can just kind of bypass? Or?
Well, if the client thinks that and they're wrong, we need to help them at some point
if
discover that they're wrong.
If the client doesn't think, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, and often with anxiety problems, people have precautions they take that they think are a good idea. And at some point, we'll need to help them discover that. Good example, I had a client with a variety of anxiety problems, and we'll talk about when we get to OCD, who heard a story in on the news about an outbreak of food poisoning in the Pacific Northwest. The thought crossed her mind, you know, if I take my kids out for fast food, they might get food poisoning and die. And from that point on, she wasn't willing to take her kids out for fast food. You know, initially, she thought this was a realistic precaution and everybody else was being, you know, overly, you know, risky by going and taking their kids for fast food. You know, now, the reality is, no, her kids aren't going to die of food poisoning if she takes them to McDonald's. But, you know, I need to think through, how do I set things up so the person can discover what they need to discover? You know, if I just say to her, no, this is dumb, take your kids to McDonald's, is that going to be effective? No way, she's just going to bail out of therapy. You know, if I, you know, stay in guided discovery mode, oh, What convinces you that it's dangerous to take your kids to McDonald's? Ah, that you story. What else makes it seem like taking your kids to McDonald's is dangerous? Do you see anything that doesn't fit with that idea? Of course, you didn't initially. Before you heard that news story, did you ever take your kids to McDonald's? Oh, yeah, all the time. How often did they get food poisoning? Never. How does that fit with the idea that if you take your kids to McDonald's, they got food poisoning? Do your friends and relatives go to McDonald's? Yeah. How often do they get food poisoning? Never. How does that fit with the idea, et cetera? And it can take some thought and some creativity to figure out how to help people discover what they need to discover, particularly if we share some of their fears. You know, for all of us who are comfortable with saying something dumb in public, this is to make it a little more challenging to help our clients overcome their own social anxiety. You know, if I have a fear of flying, it's going to make it a little harder for me to help clients deal with their fear of flying. Now, it also can be useful once I've got a handle. I don't personally don't have a fear of flying and haven't had a fear of flying. I do have a mild to moderate fear of heights. And this is useful because I got enough of a handle on it so that I understand how it works. I can go rock climbing when I want to go rock climbing. And it helps me, you know, understand what's going on for the client when they're facing what's scary to them. You know, if, you know, I had the time and energy to go rock climbing regularly, I'd get comfortable with rock climbing and stay comfortable with rock climbing. Doesn't come up with my life a whole lot. Hey, I live in Ohio. There are no mountains around here. And I've got other things I do with my spare time. You know, so I'm not going to spend enough time on tall ladders and climbing cliffs to stay comfortable with rock climbing. And so in vivo exposure is central to CBT with anxiety. We need to get people to go forth and face their fears in manageable steps and help them process their experiences so that they learn the things they need to learn from the experience. This doesn't mean that the cognitive chunk of stuff is irrelevant. I think of my lady who's so afraid to take her kids to fast food. As long as she honestly believes her kids are going to die if they go to McDonald's, she's not going to go to McDonald's. And if she doesn't go to McDonald's, she won't have the experiences it takes for her to discover that they don't die if they go to McDonald's. You know, so first we're going to need to talk it through so she registers that this is scary but not dangerous. I'm afraid that my kids will die of food poisoning if we go to McDonald's, but that's not really the way it turns out. And then, to get comfortable with McDonald's, they're going to need to go face the fears in manageable steps persistently enough to get comfortable. How's that sound? Now, this plays out a bit differently with each of the anxiety disorders, and starting this afternoon, we'll be taking the different anxiety disorders one at a time and walking through that. But first of all, let's go to the video, because I've got a good example from Chris Podesky of using guided discovery with anxiety, which should give you a much clearer image of what I'm talking about, and it's a pretty good demonstration of the cognitive chunk of this. So the therapist here is Chris Podesky, and if the machine will cooperate.
The situation of mediating this conflict between Rick and Arnold's two staff members. So Rick and Arnold are in your office. Where are you in the office when they're not in the picture? I'm probably at my desk. Okay. Is it behind the desk and they're on the other side of the desk? So is this desk, is it a big desk or is it a desk?
It's not very big now.
So one thing to notice, you know, this is somebody whose anxiety is about dealing. She's a manager. She's got two subordinates who argue with each other a lot, and she gets really anxious about dealing with their conflict. Is Chris just talking about it in abstract terms? No, she's asked the client to pick one concrete example. So they're talking about one specific occasion where the two guys are in her office getting into an argument about some work assignment.
Now, with anxiety, as we talked about before when you've been here, you're going to get more anxious the more dangerous things seem, and also the less you can see yourself coping with it. So let's do two things. Let's evaluate how dangerous this really is to you. And the two of them are there.
Then
yelling at each other. And also we can look at what you could do to cope with that better. And which side of that do you want to look at? Evaluating whether it's still dangerous or evaluating what you can do to cope better.
Well, in reality, then yelling at each other is probably not very dangerous to me.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe how I can cope with it.
How you can cope with it.
Okay.
Now, if they're standing there and they're yelling at each other, what do you imagine that you should be doing to cope with it? So that's part of where you feel stuck then. You're not sure what to do at that point.
Yeah. When people start yelling, I just completely
run. Okay. Is there anyone else that in your life that you know who you think is really good at handling that kind of situation? She told you what she does when people do that?
Well, she doesn't. She does different things. Sometimes she'll just leave the room herself. Sometimes she'll suggest that they, you know, need to calm down and talk about it when they're young.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes she'll just distract them, you know, take them to something else.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you think she decides which of those things to do? More comfortable to almost always leave the room when people are arguing. But I wonder under what circumstances your friend might stay in the room. Why do you think she might sometimes stay and tell people to calm down? Or...
Mm-hmm. Maybe if she thought she could distract them.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So she thought that she could be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
It might also, I wonder if it depends on how they're important customers or something, and she needs stay there to try to get them to work it out to make the sale.
Probably.
She might have motivation then to do it because it might be important for her.
Okay.
It would be an interesting thing you could talk to her about and find out because it sounds like she's got some important information that might be helpful to you.
Mm-hmm.
In this situation with Rick and Arnold, do you think it would be to your advantage if you knew what to do to stay in the room if they start shouting? To actually help settle things down. Would that be a good thing for you
probably,
your job?
Probably. I mean, I think it's probably what I should do.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now, you said a couple things that you're trying to do. You said that sometimes you just say to people, you need to settle down.
Right.
Is that, what effect do you think that would have if you said that to Rick and Arnold?
Well, I am their boss now.
One response, that's a possibility of a response you could do.
To tell them to settle down.
Tell them to settle down.
Down.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. That's one option. We need to come up with several options.
Okay.
But that's one option. And then the outcome of that is they might settle down and they might not.
Right.
Okay. If they do settle down, then
right.
immediate
right.
problem solved.
Right.
Maybe go on to the next problem.
Right.
Okay. What's something else your friend does? He said one other thing that she does.
Distracts them.
Distracts them.
How does she do that? She just takes me to somewhere else. She'll say, you know, let me, I forgot to show you this, or let me take you and show you something else. What about this feature over here that I...
Could you think of any way you might do that with Rick and Arnold?
If they yell at each other? It's hard for me to even get out of just being completely paralyzed when they start yelling at each other.
How about your friend that she was in the office with them? Do you think she would be able to think of something to do to distract them?
Probably.
What do you think she might do?
I think they're very upset.
I think this is a decent stopping point. Obviously, this goes on for a good while. And, you know, if the person has no image of how to handle a situation, they're going to have a very low sense of self-efficacy. They're going to find the situation real scary. You know, one chunk of what we need to do to lay the groundwork for getting the person to go forth and face their fears and manage those steps is figure out what they do want to do when they're in that situation, and get to the point where they've got a reasonable level of confidence that they can handle it. You know, we could use guided discovery, help them think it through in the session, and then say, okay, great, go do it in real life. How confident is the client going to be? Well, it depends. You know, but it wouldn't be at all surprising if having something worked out on paper does not do an incredible job of increasing their confidence, particularly if we just talk about it. Does the client know that they can pull this off successfully? Do we have any grounds for being confident that they can just go forth and do it without any practice? You know, we might well want to do some in-office practice through role plays to help them improve their skills and get to the point where they've got grounds for being confident and they can handle the situation. And Rick and, if Rick and Arnold are really challenging to deal with, we might want to have the client first practice in less challenging situations, you know, more low-conflict situations, and build up to the big situations. Or we might want her to practice in imagination, imagine different situations involving Rick and Arnold, and imagine handling it the way she'd like to be able to handle it, to get to the point where she's has a reasonable level of confidence that she can pull this off in real life. You know, another point Chris hasn't made yet, but is an important one for a lot of people who are fear conflict and avoid conflict, they hold off as long as possible before intervening. When Rick and Arnold are really upset with each other, that's a really hard point to break in and, you know, deal with the situation. If I intervened early on when they weren't yet real mad at each other, that would be a lot easier. And helping people discover that dealing with the situation sooner rather than later is a good move is often really useful. And we'll be getting into the nuts and bolts with each of the anxiety disorders. Hold that thought. I've got a couple points I want to make before I lose track of it. One question that comes up, you know, when I explain this to clients and why it's a good idea to face their fears and manageable steps and so on, some clients will say, well, wait a minute, Doc. You know, I've been flying from time to time for years, and I'm not comfortable with flying yet. If you got to face your fears, why am I not comfortable already? And there are two parts to that. One is, facing my fears and manageable steps is a great idea. If it's faced far enough apart, it's not going to add up to anything effective. If I fly once every couple of years, that's probably spaced too far apart to have any lasting effect. You know, we need more frequent practice for it to end up being beneficial. But another part of it is, suppose I'm forced into a scary situation. Does that get me comfortable? You know, let's imagine somebody with a fear of riding in elevators. Now, not the most common fear, but it comes up from time to time in our practice. we know from research and experience that they need to get on the damn elevator and ride up and down and up and down, and they'll get comfortable with it. Does that mean it would be a good idea to get four big, strong guys to drag them kicking and screaming onto the elevator and hold them there while it goes up and down? No. Obviously, A, they would sue us if we did that. But B, that's not going to make them comfortable with elevators. If I'm forced into a scary situation, it makes it more scary, and it gets in the way of getting desensitized. Now, okay, we're not going to drag the person onto the elevator, but suppose they're getting onto the elevator because they feel like they have to. For example, suppose they work downtown in a high-rise, and each day they're getting on the elevator thinking, I have to ride the damn elevator because I have to get to work. That's going to get in the way of them getting comfortable with elevators, because it seems to them that they're being forced into the situation. Now, the reality is they don't have to ride the elevator. They could walk up 30 flights of stairs if they wanted to. But as long as it seems to them they're being forced into the situation, that's going to get in the way of being desensitized. It's going to make it scarier. And this can be a big issue in working with children and adolescents. If I say to a kid, dude, you need to go face your fears to get more comfortable, your average kid is experiencing, they're going to see me as a grown-up telling them to do something. They're going to feel like they're being forced to do it. You know, unless I put some real effort into establishing and maintaining a collaborative relationship and keeping it clear in the kid's head that they're choosing to do this because they want the results, you know, if I'm not careful, they'll feel like they're doing it because their therapist is making them do it, and that's going to get in the way of getting comfortable. Yeah, and so with kids and with plenty of adults, I'm going to need to put some effort in keeping it clear in their head. No, they don't have to do this. You know, it's if they want to get more comfortable, it's to their advantage to do this. You had a question?
This kind of reminds me of a situation with one of my clients about kind of when the two of her coworkers are fighting, how it kind of gives her anxiety or whatever. But I'm kind of found it to be interesting how therapists decided to kind of more explore what are the how she could cope with that versus, or I mean, other way to go with that kind of what a kind of what is that? Does that remind her or something? Or how? I mean, what goes through her mind when they're fighting? They're bickering at
each other. And it's a question of at what point of therapy are we at? You know, if Chris doesn't yet know what goes through the client's mind when Arnold and what's his name are fighting, she needs to find that out. You know, she's already done that.
Okay.
And, you know, and if she hadn't done that already, she'd be doing that and not this. And you remember, you know, at the beginning you mentioned they've been working on anxiety for several sessions.
Okay.
You know, she's already helped the client understand that there's my perception of the danger in the situation and my perception of my capability to handle it. And she asked the client, does the client have a preference about which of those to focus on now? And the client said, well, I already know it's scary but not dangerous,
okay. But
I don't feel capable of dealing with it. That's what we need to focus on.
Okay. So
and so part of it was what point of therapy we're at. Part of it is Chris is thinking of what do we need to accomplish next. And part of it is taking the client's preferences seriously.
You might also want to know if she's got any experience handling similar situations outside of work. You know, like, so maybe she does already have that skill.
Yeah,
but
sometimes people already have the skills and don't think to apply them in this situation, too. And other times people just don't have the skills at all. From what we can see on the videotape, it sounds like this lady has a real hard time dealing with conflict across the board. But, you know, I don't know any more about the video than you guys do. One last thought is, you know, when we're trying to understand be, you know, what the client's afraid of, what they avoid, what precautions they take. You know, sometimes it's as simple as asking them and they tell us. Great, it's nice when life is easy. There are also plenty of times when the client says, I don't know what I'm afraid of, or there's nothing to be afraid of. You know, one thing that's real useful is take a specific example, specific situation. You know, for the person with a fear of dogs, you know, can they think of a time when they were confronted by a dog and felt really scared? What was the situation? What led up to it? What were they feeling? What thoughts do they remember running through their head? And often it's real enlightening. It often takes a little more work to pinpoint thoughts with anxiety than with depression. Why? Well, when people are depressed, what do? Many people, when they're depressed, they sit and think. You know, when people are anxious, what do? They run away screaming. They're not sitting there thinking and paying attention to what they're thinking. They're focused on whatever it is they're afraid of and how to avoid it. And so, you know, may well take a little more work on our part to get the person to pause and notice what's running through their head. They can't tell us about it until they notice it. And for all the people saying, there's nothing to be afraid of, often this is a manifestation of their strategies for dealing with anxiety. They're trying to make the anxiety go away by telling themselves there's nothing to be afraid of. It doesn't work, and it gets in the way of, you know, finding out what their fears are. You know, and, you know, so we may need to, you know, get them to put that on hold and pause and say, okay, right, there's nothing, you know, you're telling yourself there's nothing to be afraid of. But in the heat of the moment, what's going through your head? And this is also one where it's often hard for people to spot the thoughts because they seem so obvious and self-evident. You know, if you run into a bear in the woods, you know, and you're scared, a lot of people claim there are no thoughts running through my head. You know, well then what's bad news about bears in the woods? Well, it might eat me. Ah, so it sounds like on some level, you know, there's some thinking about the bear might eat me. Now, with depression, thoughts and words are usually what's important. Yes, because of how depression works. With anxiety, sometimes a person has thoughts and words marching through. When I run into the bear in the woods, I may find myself thinking, oh my God, a bear, it might eat me. That's possible. Not likely, but possible. You know, I might have an image of the bear smacking its teeth and lips with bits of my clothing stuck between its teeth. That communicates the same message. And imagery often plays a more important role in cognition with anxiety than it does with depression. Or I may just have an abstract sense that bears in the woods are dangerous to hikers. You know, that's also cognition. It's a little harder to get at because the person hasn't translated it into words to tell me about it. And it's also a good example that it's a lot easier to be afraid in the areas of life where we don't know a whole lot about it. My lady, with the fear of food poisoning from fast food, hardly knew anything about food poisoning. She had this image that if you get food poisoning, you die. Wait a minute, is that what happens if one gets food poisoning? No, if you get food poisoning, you feel like you're dying. You might feel it's like a really bad case of the flu. And if you're in ordinary health, you're likely to be just fine in a few days. You know, if you don't know anything about a particular area of life, it's harder to sort out, is this dangerous or just scary? You know, if you run into a bear in the woods in Ohio, it's the eastern black bear. It's not aggressive. As soon as it spots you, it's going to get away from you unless you're between it and its cub or the neighbors have been dumb enough to be feeding the bears. You know, all you need to do is back off quietly and you'll be fine. You know, or you can wave your arms and yell boo and the bear will run away. You know, it's the grizzlies that are dangerous. No grizzlies in Ohio. And the less somebody knows about bears, the harder it is sort out, is this a dangerous situation or a scary situation or somewhere in between? That's it for this morning. It is now lunchtime. Barb will be here at 2 and we'll get to specific phobias first, which is the simplest, most straightforward of the anxiety disorders.